A serious stabbing in Waukesha last week, where two 12-year-old girls were allegedly trying to win the approval of a fictional online character they believe to be real, has a lot of people scratching their heads. This hour, we'll zero in on how the online media landscape may be affecting our youth and what to do about it. Good morning. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 6:08 on Monday, June 9th. Are you a parent? Do you know what your child is looking at on the internet? How do you monitor your teen's internet activity? And how do you effectively teach them to draw the line between fantasy and reality? We'll explore these questions and invite your calls this hour at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour is Joanne Cantor. She's Outreach Director of the Center for Communication Research and a Professor Emerita of Communication Arts at the UW-Madison. Professor Cantor, thanks for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, reportedly these two girls got reality and fantasy confused, it sounds like, because of their interest in the online character Slenderman. Can you help us understand what exactly may have led to this on a psychological level?
Well, first of all, let me say that when something this tragic and bizarre happens, there are a lot of bad things that probably coincided to push girls in this direction. We don't see cause and effect. You look at this website and you become an attempted murderer, but clearly this website was one influence pushing the girls in that direction. Now, when you talk about fantasy and reality, it's a lot more complicated than it seems, because people's first reaction is, well, they should know the difference between fantasy and reality. But fantasy and reality get mixed together very easily in the media. First of all, a lot of things that are fictional have elements of reality in them. So there may be a fictional story about a homicidal maniac in the woods. You may know that's fiction, but kids know that there is such a thing as a homicidal maniac. I mean, those people exist. They could be possible. So that's one element. And another element is the supernatural. In the studies I've done of kids' reactions to movies and their long-term reactions, the supernatural is hard to really totally reject by many people, even adults. So people know, for example, that the Wicked Witch of the West is just a fictional character by the time they're 7 or 8. But remember the movie The Blair Witch Project, which was very scary to, you know, even college students. And, it's also true that there are thousands of web pages for witches, okay? So our whole society is always allowing for that ambiguity. This is also true for, alien attacks from outer space. We know at some level that the alien attack we see in a movie is not real, but we also don't know that it's impossible, because there may be life in outer space. So it's very easy, particularly at a young age, like 10, 11, or 12, to be confused by these stories that, there is this strange slender man in the woods. So the fantasy-reality distinction, you know, a lot of people besides these very unusual young women who got involved in a very tragic, horrible thing, who are confused about fantasy reality, particularly in these very emotion-evoking programs and websites.
And certainly at around that age, it's still fun to play pretend and sort of delve into a world of fantasy. But when does it cross the line into being a little bit too unreal, where we're blurring the lines between the two?
Well, one of the things is, if you don't have a counterforce, if you don't have the opportunity to talk to somebody who who can say, hey, you know, get out of this fantasy and realize that in the real world, nothing like this would happen the way it's happening, in the media. But if kids are spending all their time with the media and not talking to their parents or other people who have a more realistic view of life, it can just grow and grow and fester in there and go into strange outcomes. Now, another thing, I think there's something new about this. You know, we've had scenes of copycats, you know, horrible tragedies where kids have tried to imitate, you know, Superman by jumping out the window and thinking they could fly, or copying crimes. This has been going on since we've had mass media. But what's new and different here is that the internet not only makes it, gives kids so many more possibilities of macabre and evil and strange things to get involved with, but it's also interactive. So kids don't just see one thing that somebody creates. Kids see an endless number of iterations on that theme because everybody can contribute to this wiki, this interactive site. And also they can encounter a peer group of people who are also interested and obsessed with this character, and they can be reinforced. Rather than coming into contact with people who are skeptical, they come in contact with people who are really into this and also who express criticisms of the people who are skeptical and say, don't believe your parents. You know, this is really true no matter what they say. So the internet provides all this fan interaction that normal mass media that we've had, that we had in the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, that was just one way.
And going back to that counterforce, then it seems that the counterforce needs to be much stronger, given the reinforcement that's available online. Whose responsibility is that?
Well, you know, parents have an important responsibility to understand what their kids are doing, and the problem is it's harder and harder for parents. You know, when I was growing up, We had, you know, this is really ancient history. We had one television in the house, and it was in the living room, and everybody knew what was on. And, you know, then suddenly there were televisions everywhere in the house. And you had to, you know, parents have always been advised by, you know, common sense people to keep those televisions out of the kids' bedroom and monitor what they watch. But now suddenly kids have their own computers, and they even have their own smartphones, so they can carry them around in their pockets. And so that makes it even harder for a parent who wants to know what the kids are doing to know what they're doing. And so although it's the parents' responsibility, the parents are up against a much greater challenge than they ever were. So parents really, you know, should find out what it is their kids are spending hours and hours with. And they are spending, you know, the electronic media and digital devices are taking bigger and bigger portions of children's lives. So they need to know what kids are watching.
Mm-hmm.
Either, you know, if they can monitor it, they should. You know, there are some devices for checking out what kids are seeing. There are some devices for limiting the time kids spend on their digital devices. Or they should talk to their kids about what they're watching and interacting with, and having these open conversations
and
very important.
We'll talk about how to open those conversations coming up after the break. We're talking with Joanne Cantor. She's Outreach Director of the Center for Communication Research and Professor Emerita of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. And we're welcoming your thoughts, your questions as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org or leave a comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Do you monitor your children's internet activity? And how do you think online media affect our children? You can let us know. You can also perhaps pick our guest's brain for a bit of advice here on how to open those conversations with your children. 800-642-1234. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Joanne Cantor, Outreach Director of the Center for Communication Research and Professor Emerita of Communication Arts at UW-Madison, about how online media can impact our children. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Professor Cantor, I want to ask you a little bit about how to open a dialogue with our children. That's where we left off before the break. How do we do that? It can be hard, especially with adolescents and teens. I think they're at peak eye-rolling phase of their life at that point. So how do we effectively talk to them about what they're doing on the internet?
Well, you're absolutely right about the eye-rolling thing. And that's really, it makes it very challenging to talk to teens about to get teens to talk to you about anything. Well, how was school today? What did you do? Nothing. You know, that's the way it's typical. I think, first of all, you have to start out in a non-judgmental framework. Not because they're going to expect criticism the minute they tell you. And so, one thing to do is just to ask, I'd love to see the kinds of things you're doing. I'd love to have you explain this to me. Let's look at it, if you don't mind, and let's just talk about what happens in it. Tell me, what do you like about it, or what do you think your friends like about it? Sometimes it's easier to ask kids to talk about their friends than to talk about themselves. Mm. What do your friends tell you that they like about it? And then start talking about the plots. Tell me about, you know, what's going on, and tell me about, you know, what it is you like about it. Is it the characters? Do they do interesting things? And then try and get them in a conversation about the reality and fantasy of it. What do you think, for example, would happen in the real world if somebody did that? And how else could you react, you know, if it's a danger situation and the solution is always violence? Are there other ways? Could you call the police? Could you change the person's mind? Whatever. But really, just allow it to be a conversation in which you don't have an authority figure tamping down on a child, but where you have two people who are interested in just talking about these things. And then don't expect to have one conversation and have it all, everything solved. Expect your first conversation not to get very far. And don't insist on winning every argument. Just say, well, you know, let's talk about this again because I'm really interested. And you know, possibly you can make conversations something that they have to do to have the privilege of internet access. But so that's one way. Another thing is, you know, it's very healthy parenting practice to limit the amount of time kids can spend with their digital devices, and that's hard too. But kids should not allow these very attractive entertainment and connection machines to completely dominate their lives. There are many other things to do that are healthier and more interesting. So you know, not banning it altogether, but encouraging a balance of activities, some of which don't involve electronic media, is very healthy.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from John in Boaz. Hi, John.
Hi. I rewarded my son when he was young, when he was young, and I gave him a choice as a father. I said, Josh, you read books. I'll give you a penny a page. And it's like How to Become a Millionaire in 3 days, you know. You read those things. But I gave him, it was 100 pages, I gave him a dollar, right? So he now is graduated from UWM with a master's degree in information technology.
Congratulations.
And, you know, that's so I kept him away from the media, digital media.
Thanks for your call, John. So that's one way. Maybe incentivize your child to find other forms of entertainment.
Right. And you know, pay for doing good things. You know, that's probably a good way to start. Hopefully then, and this probably happened with John's son, he discovered that, wow, reading is pretty interesting, and I don't even need to be paid for it anymore because that's something that I enjoy. And one of the, you know, one of the problems of today is that because the internet changes so rapidly and it's full of sound bites and videos and everything, that people stop having the patience to sit and just read word after word, page after page. So it's important in order to grow this love of reading, parents need to, you know, not just say, well, go to the library and find something. If parents can, you know, go to the library and get good recommendations. My son is really interested in football, or he likes bugs, or he likes, you know, dinosaurs, to find some really well-written, enticing books so that kids will really find that content so interesting that they want to turn off their smartphone for an hour and really concentrate on this. So you know, one of the things that's very clear about parenting research is just saying no is not only ineffective, it often has the opposite of effect. It makes whatever you're trying to prohibit more attractive. So what you have to do is substitute something that's attractive for whatever it is. And if, you know, it's easy for busy parents to say, oh, just do what you're doing because I really am busy. But if there's a way you can incorporate into your day a time where you actively help your child find those interesting things that are going to captivate their imagination, rather than just saying no, you're going to have a much better chance of having a child who then goes for the healthier and more stimulating and more educational options over time.
Well, it seems a little bit ironic then that the issue we're talking about or that sparked this conversation was with the Slender Man online. I believe it was a series of stories and storytelling that was you know, collectively contributed to this website on the internet. So it definitely captivated the young girls that were engaged with it. I'm wondering, you know, what could the parents have done if they had only known to help prevent this blurring of reality and fantasy?
Well, I think if parents had known, hopefully they could have started discussions and had a counterweight to this notion that this is true. I mean, the girls took it so far, not only stabbed their friend, but they were planning to run away and live in the woods with this fictional character. Mm-hmm. All of this is total fantasy, and they didn't tell anybody, you know, probably for a reason, they loved the fantasy for some reason, and they didn't want anybody to tell them it wasn't true. They didn't want a reality check. That's what parents, you know, and a good friend who wasn't sucked into this would have done, is to say, this couldn't possibly happen, and what would happen to you then, and what about, what about murder and all of these things. And it's interesting, if you read the newspapers, they were sensitive to, the moral aspect of what they were doing. I mean, when they went out and they had the knife and they were in a position to stab her, according to the reports, they kept saying, oh, no, you go first. No, you go first. Mm-hmm. I can't do it. They had the normal hesitancy and revulsion to, stick a knife into their friend. And yet the emotional impact of this fantasy was so powerful that it eventually overcame their normal reticence to do this. So yeah. If there had been just one, one person who knew and could have, shaken them back to reality, maybe things would have happened entirely differently.
We're talking with Joanne Cantor. She's Outreach Director of the Center for Communications Research and Professor Emerita of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. We'll be back with her after the news. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about how online media affect young minds and how to effectively teach our children to maintain healthy boundaries between fantasy and reality. Specifically, how to open dialogues about how our kids are using the internet. Good morning. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 6:36 on Monday, June 9th. We're talking with Joanne Cantor. She's Outreach Director of the Center for Communication Research and Professor Emerita of Communication Arts at UW-Madison. You can join our conversation this hour at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can tweet us at Joy Cardine Show or email us at talk@wpr.org. Professor Cantor, I'm wondering if you think it's advisable for for parents to discuss a case like that out of Waukesha with their children, and if so, how do we do it?
Well, if it depends on their age. I wouldn't start too young, five or six, maybe too young. And yet, I mean, this case in Wisconsin is so big. Chances are, kids are going to hear about it. And I think you can use it as a teachable moment. And as I said before, it may be easier to talk about other kids to your kids than to talk about themselves. So it may be a way of getting into a conversation about how this might have happened, what went wrong, what did, ask the kids, what should their parents have done? And so let the kids role play being parents of these kids, and maybe that would be a way into getting this dialogue going. And a child's eye rolling might say, normally they would say, oh gosh, everybody knows this is not real. I know it's not real. But then if you can start with this case in Waukesha by saying, well, what happened to these girls? These seem to be pretty normal girls. Why did that happen to them? So I think it's a good idea to talk to kids about bad things that happen to other kids and get them involved in thinking about this from new perspectives. So that's in a sense, this is a teachable moment that. It's a wake-up call to parents, but I think it's also an opportunity for parents to get into a good conversation with their kids where the kids can realize that they're not being directly attacked. And it's not that parents don't trust their kids, but that what's going on in the web is very new, and we have to learn how to deal with it in a way that's fun but not tragic.
I was reading in the New York Times yesterday. They had reported briefly on this, and they were talking specifically about how the community of Waukesha is responding and how parents in the community might be more ambivalent about sending their kids to, you know, other friends' sleepovers and other things. What's your advice to parents who might look at this story and then therefore start to fear that this type of thing could happen to their own child?
Well, I think another important thing is for parents to talk to each other and take a more active role. You know, as kids become teenagers, they become more and more independent, and that's a good thing. But, you know, when your child goes over to Johnny's house or Becky's house or whatever, talk to, you know, get to know the parents of the place they're going. Is this a is this a place where kids are monitored or left alone? Is this a place where you just go there to spend endless hours on the internet, or is this a place where other things are going on? Because, yes, I mean, it's normal for parents to start thinking, oh my gosh, I never thought of this. And rather than restricting their children too heavily, which can often backfire, to just take a little more time to figure out what is going on in these situations. So that kids, I mean, the ultimate goal is to have your child grow up healthy and independent and making positive choices for themselves. I mean, one of the other tricky things is if you continually restrict and clamp down your kids' activities, then either when they're at their friends or when they, you know, get out of the house and have total control over their time, then they're not going to have developed any internal critical thinking about what they're doing with their time and what how much time their brain is spending on violent, macabre things. Another thing that occurred to me to say is that our culture now and our most popular movies and television shows really revel in the violent, macabre characters whose goal it is just to kill others. And so those are the characters, the violent, monster becomes the hero today rather than the villain. And so, you know, you can see why young girls might adore this Slender Man character for no other reason than he's, apparently he's sort of sexy, but he's also extremely violent, and his goal is just apparently to kill children or to gather them together. In a cult, it's almost like this story is a little bit like a gang. In order to impress the head of the gang, to be able to join the gang, you have to kill somebody. And this, this is kind of a sick idea, but it becomes very attractive when it's put together with cultural things that are attractive to kids. So all of this, our entire culture is moving in a direction where violence is even more and more applauded or made attractive by so much of our media, not just what's going on the internet.
Casey on Facebook writes, my daughter is almost 12 and told me about Slender Man last year. She had no illusions about the character being real and was not obsessed by him. Neither were her friends. I think before we blame the internet for this horrible stabbing incident, we should step back and look at the incredible social and educational opportunities it provides. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not against the internet at all. And in fact, and a lot of kids enjoy things like this without any negative consequences. And so that's, as I said, a lot of things have to go wrong to end up in a tragedy. And, you've got the really healthy kids who take it in small doses and enjoy it and then go on and have other interests and are not negatively affected. But I don't think we should say that only those girls who stab their friends are negatively affected. There's probably a lot of kids in this intermediate phase who will never end up in the press, but who become obsessed and spend too much time with the macabre and really have long-term anxieties and fears and paranoid feelings about the world and, you know, and may refuse to engage in other normal activities that say they see as dangerous now because they're viewing the world through this negative eye. So, yes, I mean, I think the Internet is wonderful in so many ways. It's got all these positive opportunities and all these negative opportunities, and that's why we should embrace it, of course. But we should teach our kids to be selective so that they spend more time on the positive stuff and maybe for entertainment, you know, not, you know, for reasonable periods of time, they look at the negative stuff and are able to distinguish between, you know, a fun thrill that's definitely not realistic and the real world.
And you had mentioned earlier in the program that there are devices that parents could use if they are concerned about what their child is doing on the Internet. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how, aside from continuing a dialogue with their children, how can parents be more engaged with what's going on online?
Right. Well, parents, it used to be easier when there was just a computer and you could, you know, there are ways of blocking certain sites. On the computer, and there are ways of blocking by content, by content name. There are certain there's certain ways of looking at using ratings to block content. But now with so many devices, I've just heard about a new device that is just recently on the market called Web Curfew. And with that, you can control not just your computer, but you control all the devices that come into your home through the Internet. And you can say, well, I'm going to shut off my 10-year-old's Internet access starting at 8 o'clock at night and my 14-year-old's at 10 o'clock at night so they don't, you know, so they're not doing this all night. But also, you can find out what sites they are going to, so you can, without blocking those, you can block certain sites, but you could also just have a readout of what they're watching, so you can say, hey, I see you're looking at this strange site. Let's talk about this. Can we have this conversation, and can you assure me that this is a good thing, or should we talk about maybe weaning you away from that? So these kinds of things, more and more, are going to be helpful to parents as a way of making it more convenient to control not just the computer, but all these little devices. And so it's not a panacea. You have to have the conversation, too, but at least it may help so that parents don't have to throw up their hands and say, oh, my gosh, there's just so many ways they can access to this. I can't do it. You know, it's just technically impossible. But take those devices out of the bedroom. I mean, first of all, kids are losing sleep just because no matter what they're doing, they may just be talking to their friends. But if they're, you know, texting their friends all night long, they're not getting sleep. And, you know, lack of sleep causes a host of physical and emotional problems that are just not good for a kid's development.
Well, in our last couple of minutes with you here, you've studied the effects of electronic media on youth for many years, and I'm wondering, as you've looked at this case, what stands out to you as unique or perhaps the most teachable lesson we can learn in this changing landscape?
Well, what's unique, I think, is the vastness of the Internet and also the interactivity of the Internet that allows kids not just to be exposed to this material, but to interact with it, you know, to not only contribute to it, but then to talk, you know, then to interact on the web with like-minded kids who are also obsessed. And so this is what's new, the internet and its vastness and its interactivity that make it just more compelling and more likely to have a strong effect than even, you know, TV and movies, which, by the way, are also extremely compelling and can have incredibly strong effects that have long-lasting effects on emotions and feelings of, you know, feelings of well-being. The internet is just taking it one step further. It's here to stay. It's a good thing, but it requires more parental guidance than even what I started looking at many, many years ago.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Joanne Cantor, Outreach Director of the Center for Communication Research and Professor Emerita of Communication Arts at the UW-Madison. She's joined us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine.